thought we could talk about something maybe a bit deeper than usual. If you're not into heavies, then you could leave now. But Lag BaOmer is a time that is actually the festival of the hidden wisdom, as you probably know. It's the time of the Kabbalistic revelation. Rav Shimon bar Yochai was the person who brought the Zohar to the world. That's a time when the central section of the Zohar, which is the Kabbalistic, the source of our Kabbalistic wisdom, that was revealed on Lag BaOmer. I presume that people are aware of that. Rav Shimon Yochai died. In fact, it says in the Zohar that the sun didn't go down until he finished bringing out the hidden wisdom. Two other people were there, six or seven people, maybe ten. And then the sun went down, and then he died on that day. And the remarkable thing about it is that everything's remarkable about it. That these things were revealed in the first place, that although he died on that day, we had a celebration on this day. Usually we mark a yahrzeit of somebody with a fast or with something, not a celebration. Why exactly? What is a celebration? What exactly is the happy thing that's going on today? And how is it connected to a revelation of depth in Torah? As long as my tongue holds out, try and discuss it. So let's start like this. We have a remarkable idea. We've spoken over the last couple of years about the idea of Sphira, how the 49 counting, how the counting of 49 stages, what it actually means. And we've tried to describe before, you can refer to the discussion on cassette, discussion that's recorded, about what is the meaning of the 33rd day. The fact that it's the fifth day of the fifth week, right, which is what the mystics call Chod Shebohot, which is the, there's no way to translate it really, but it's that mystical point that's represented by the left kidney, if you like. What that means, we've tried to go into that before. See if we can maybe bring out an aspect of this whole subject in the next few minutes together that is something we haven't seen. I'll tell you the words, and then we'll see how much we merit to be able to understand. The words are as follows. There's a statement in the Arizal, the Rav Shimon bar Yochai wrote the Zohar, the one who explained it to us, the one whose, teachings are the way that we have access to the Zohar is through the teachings of the Arizal. Arizal lived in Tzfas in the 1500s, and he taught, he never actually wrote, but what he taught to his main student, Rav Chaim Vital, is written down in the Eitz Chaim, and the books that we have today, that people who study the Kabbalistic wisdom, they study those works. What those works are the teachings that are contained within the Zohar, but made explicit. You might read them and not think that they're explicit at all. They're very, very hidden, but for people who study these things, they are a way of making understandable what is written in the Zohar. The Arizal says the following statement, and there is I think it's in Shara Gilgulim, which is a section in which it deals with reincarnation. I presume everyone's aware that the belief in reincarnation is a Kabbalistic, a Jewish belief. Didn't come from the East. It went to the East from Kabbalistic wisdom. We believe that there's such a thing, that many people, perhaps most of us, have actually been here before, and we get sent down here again to do things that we didn't do correctly the first time. Now, in that discussion, he makes the following statement. He says that, let's try and understand it. I'll tell you the words, and then we'll try and say what he's talking about, and then if we can, we'll try and explore a bit about what it means. He says that 24,000 students of Rebbe Akiva died during Sphira Solomon, right? That is well known, and that is whenever you read why we observe customs of sort of semi-mourning during Sphira Solomon for these 7 weeks, it's because we know that it's a dangerous time. In fact, the danger is manifest by the fact that 12,000 pairs, 24,000 students of Rebbe Akiva, died during this time, but they died only on 33 of the days of the 49 days. According to some opinions, there were 33 days, or the first 32 days they died. On the 33rd day, the plague stopped and they didn't die. From then on, according to other opinions, there were 32 of the days throughout the 49 that people died on, but there were 33 days that they didn't, there were 33 days on which no death took place, put it that way. But the point is that the number 33, what's called Lag Ba'omer, Lamed Gimel, the 33rd day of the Omer, which is the fifth day of the fifth week, if you really think about it, which is what tonight is, a time of happiness, a time when no one died, or when the plague stopped, or when no one knew got ill, who wasn't already lethally sick from before, according to different opinions. The point is that it was a special day of happiness, this particular time. But before we get to the idea of the happiness, or the idea of this negativity stopping on this day, we have to understand, why did they die? 24,000 of his students died on this day. During this time of year. Before we discuss that, let me just complete the statement. He says this. During the time that the Jews were in the desert, during the time that we went from Pesach towards Shavuos, or at least during that time in the desert that we spent, whether it was in those 49 days or whether it was much later during the travels in the desert, the point is that there was a plague that broke out among the Jewish people, you may remember, and it just so happens that 24,000 Jews died then. A plague that broke out because of the sons, the Bnei Shimon, the tribe of Shimon. They did something wrong, and a plague broke out and 24,000 people died in that plague. Now, that's what it says in Chumash. In the Gemara it says that Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 Talmidim who died at this time of year. Says the Arizal, listen carefully, the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva were the reincarnations, they were the Gilgulim, they were the same souls as those 24,000 who died in the desert many centuries before. Those 24,000, because of what they'd done wrong, they didn't survive. A plague broke out and they were decimated. They were sent down to the world again to try and correct or complete the thing they'd done wrong. And in the days of Rabbi Akiva, they happened to be sent down in the form of his students, and they didn't manage to correct what they had not corrected, or they didn't manage to complete what it was that they were supposed to complete the first time, and they died again. And that's why it happened. That's what he says. Now, that's very mysterious. Let us try and follow, if we can, a little bit of the idea. I'm not claiming it's easy. Subtle and deep ideas. Because maybe once a year, like Bom is the time, we can try and bring out that the lights of that inner fire, which hopefully can bring out some of these deeper ideas that are normally not available to us. Let's see if we can try that. What's the connection between these events? What's it got to do with the Sefirot Omer? What does it have to do with Lag Ba'Omer? Let's try and first of all understand the events before we listen to their inner meaning. The events were that when we were in the desert, a certain negative event happened. Let me tell you the details. There was a man called Zimri, a prince of the tribe of Shimon, who went and took a non-Jewish woman, the name was Cosby, from the Midianim, a tribe, or a nation of people who were forbidden to, of course, marry the Jewish people. They weren't Jewish. And Zimri went and he took a woman, he took Cosby, and he had a relationship with her, and because of that he was killed. It says that Pinchas saw what was happening, and he went into the tent where the two of them were, and he ran them both through with a spear, killed them, and carried them around the campsite, camp of the Jewish nation, and that stopped the plague. When the Bnei Shimon stood around, and when Zimri took Cosby, and he started to have a relationship with this non-Jewish woman, what happened was a terrible plague broke out, and the plague killed 24,000 people because of that sin. Why were so many involved, since only one man did wrong? Because others were not negative about it and didn't stop him, especially the Bnei Shimon. They stood around. If I'm not mistaken, the 24,000 died from them alone. I'm not sure about that, but I think so. The point is, it's held as if they're accountable, because the Bnei Shimon stood around and they didn't stop their prince Zimri from doing this terrible act. In fact, the heroism of Pinchas was that he had a break through the lines of the men of Shimon who were standing around protecting their leader, and miraculously he was saved. They weren't able to harm him, and that's what happened. Now, to give you a bit more detail, what happened was this. When it says that Zimri came in front of Moshe Rabbeinu, and he brought in front of him this woman who was not Jewish, and he said, "Tell me, is this woman permitted to me or not? And if you say she's not permitted, who gave you permission to marry Tzipora?" Because Tzipora, Moshe's wife, was from a non-Jewish nation originally also. Now, she was the daughter of Yisrael, not going into the girl's conversion, not conversion, the point is that's what he said. At that moment, Moshe Rabbeinu forgot the halacha. He was supposed to, what he should have said, what needed to be said then, was that it's forbidden for this man to have a relationship with a non-Jewish woman, and that somebody who does that in such a blatant way forfeits his life, and a person's allowed to kill him on the spot, actually. I mean, I'm not saying that you should take matters into your own hands the next time you see a Jewish boy as a girlfriend who's not Jewish, but the point is, that is the extent of the spiritual nature of that relationship between a Jew and a non-Jew, is that there's no spiritual connection that can be made at all, and it's forbidden. And they all stood around, and Moshe Rabbeinu didn't say it. And Pinchas had to supply the answer. He said, Moshe Rabbeinu, didn't you once teach us? I learned from you. When you came down from the mountain, I learned that if a Jewish man has a relationship with a non-Jewish woman like this, he forfeits his life. And Moshe said to him, let the one who brings the letter read it. Meaning, that if you know it, you can carry it out. And he went in and killed him. Now, because the B'nai Shimon stood around, and they didn't know this, they didn't say this, they didn't say that it was forbidden, they didn't prevent it, they died. Or a plague broke out and 24,000 of them died. It was only stopped when Pinchas was able to teach this halacha. And he was able to bring out this tradition, this halacha, this oral law, that such is the forbidden nature of this relationship and that a Jewish man forfeits his life in such circumstances. When he was able to bring that out and act on it, then the plague stopped. Let's jump in history some centuries to the time when Rabbi Akiva was teaching Torah, and all his students had 24,000 Talmidim. A plague broke out among them and they all died. Why did they die? So it says in the Gemara, Mipnei shelo nagu kovod zebaze. They didn't treat each other with honor. You hear that? They didn't treat each other with a special kind of honor, not as much as they should have, and because of that they died. It was this time of year, between Pesach and Shavuos, and somehow this time of year is a time when they had to do that more strongly, and therefore because they failed to do it at this time of year, when that is the energy that's around in the spiritual world, they were culpable and they died because of that. It does not say that they belittled each other. It doesn't say, it doesn't say that they belittled each other, or they put each other down, or they insulted each other. It doesn't say that. It just says that they didn't honor each other, that's all. They were fine. They were fine with each other. They were neutral. They were friendly. But they didn't honor each other to a certain extent at their great level that they should have, because they didn't bring out that thing called kovod, what means honor of another human being, of their fellow students in the yeshiva. Because of that, they died. Now let's try and understand this. What's the connection between these events? Why are they the Gilgal, the reincarnation of those neshamas? What's the connection between them? Why was there a crime? And what's the connection between the crimes? That only when Pinchas was able to say what the halacha was, that the plague stopped, and in the days of Rabbi Akiva, they weren't able to prevent their deaths, and only when that number had died, and as it happens, it was the 33rd day of the Omer, like the Omer, then they stopped dying. It's a very mystical, mysterious connection. What is the connection between them? Let's study a few deeper ideas together and see if we can try and understand something. The fact that they didn't treat each other with honor, what means that they didn't show honor towards each other. Then the mystics point out that the word kavod, kavod, which means honor, adds up to 32. Spell it out, you'll see. It comes out to 32. 22 and 10. Chav base is 22 and above dalet is 10, which symbolizes or means the 22 letters of the Hebrew aleph base and the 10 mystical spheres or mystical dimensions or energies, whatever you want to call them. Those together form the 32 that are called the Lamed Beis Nesivos Chochma, the 32 pathways of wisdom, hidden wisdom. That's what the 32 are. That's the dangerous time. 32 is always dangerous because the wisdom is being built. The inner world is being built then. That's the world of Kavod, the world of significance. Kavod means honor, but it also means heaviness. Something is not light, which means it's easy to scoff at or belittle or move. It has weight, it has significance. That's what's being built. Of course, I'm sure you haven't missed the point that all the inner being of a Jew is put into these 32 dimensions. The heart of a Jew, which is the center of his being, in Hebrew is Lev. Lev is Lamed Beis, 32. So that we have here a number of ideas that start to come together. Kovod, which means the the honor that a person, the deep honor of a person, what these Talmidim should have brought out of each other, the honor of a person is 32. 33 is Yusayf already. Once you have 33, you're beyond where the work has been done. The whatever's been built has been built already. From there on in, it's just a question of helping it, of nurturing it, nourishing it, letting it grow, let it come out into the world. But the hidden part, which is always the part that's dangerous, the planned dimension, the conception of the child, the pregnancy, all the hidden parts of growth, there are 32 of those. Actually, the Kabbalistic sources that say that the 49 days of the Omer actually are Lev Tov, a good heart. Lev is 32 and Tov is 17. Those are 49. The good part is the days that come after the 32. Lev is the 32 days of inner work that you have to build. You have to work on yourself to build the world of the heart of Lev. And then you have Tov, the good part, which is the time after Lag BaOmer when the tension is off and the work has been done. Lev Tov. But before you get to the Tov, you first have the Lev, which is the 32 dangerous elements that all have to be put together. Why that works out to be the fifth of the fifth week, I'm not going to go into now. That's what we discussed last year. Same idea, looked at from a different angle. What is this honor? What is this inner kavod, this inner honor, this depth of a human being that has to be brought out? The answer is it's Torah. We know that it says that the world was created only for Torah. It was built on the pattern of Torah. It says, Istakel Bo'irasu Bara Alma, Hashem looked into the Torah and created the world. The world's just a reflection of Torah. Everything in the world is a manifestation of Torah. Actually, we understand that it's a manifestation of Torah Shebaal Peh. It's the oral law, which is what brings out the written law into a form that can actually be apprehended in the world. It's what makes it real. If you like, the Torah in its written form is the mitzvahs, and the oral law is how you actually apply them, how you bring them out into the world, the how of the mitzvahs. The mitzvahs, the written law is the what, and the oral law is how you actually bring it out, how you actually apply it in the world. So the world is actually built on the way that we do the mitzvahs according to the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law. So kavod means the preciousness, the significance of the lev, of the heart, which is the inner being of a person, which is the extent to which he builds that honor, which is Torah. You know that this idea of kavod, this honor that is my own glory, my own honor, my own glory, this is not just a poetic idea. You know that in Hebrew we have a custom to call somebody by the word honor. I mean, in English they've taken that on as well when they say your honor. But that comes really from the Hebrew source. When we really want to refer to a person in a dignified way, we don't refer to him, we refer to the honor of that person, because actually that's the heart of the person. In Hebrew, when you want to address somebody that you respect very much, you say, Mashlom Kvodo. What? How is his honor? I mean, in English, it has a faint echo, yes, but somebody's supposed to know something in English, you refer to as his honor. But it's just a device, but in Hebrew, you're actually referring to the primus, to the internality of that person. Not just being respectful, you're actually denoting the essence of who that person is. And that honor that actually should be manifest in the world. You have in many places in Tehillim, in the writings, in Torah Shebaal Peh, it actually refers to a person's neshama, to his soul, as his honor. Like it says, Ura Kavodi, awake my honor. But it doesn't mean my honor, it means my soul, awake my soul. Or it says, L'manya Zamercha Kovit, in order that my honor should praise you. It doesn't mean my honor, it means my neshama, it means me, it means the innermost depth of my neshama. But we refer to it as Kovit, which is the same as Lev, which is the 32 elements of the inner building. The 17 are how I manifest it on the outside, after I've built the inner content. But the Kovit dimension, the hidden inner dimension, is what is built on the outside. The depth of this idea of Kovit is that this inner world has to be brought out in such a way. Let me see if I can try and express this adequately. If you take something that's inward and you bring it outward, then you destroy it, don't you? Because it's no longer. If its nature is to be inward, and you bring it out, then you haven't brought it out. You've destroyed it. Let's see. The ladies understand. The ladies understand because the most potent depth of this in the world is a woman's honor, which is her modesty. If that modesty is exposed on the outside, it's not modesty anymore. So then it's not the thing itself. It's a prostitution, a perversion of what the thing should be. Let's understand again. What's built on the inside is not just something that can be shown on the outside. What's built on the inside is the inside of me. It's the neshama. If that neshama, which is the internal life force of mine, is shown on the outside, but then it's not a life energy, it's an external thing. What's built on the inside is not just something that happens to be inside. It's the fact that it's inside that's what's being built. It's the internality, it's the inner content of what I am. It's the inner workings of what I am. In fact, the mystics say it's the fact that it's inside and hidden that makes it what it is. So of course when you make it exposed, so then you don't have it anymore. What's the solution? Are we together? These are not easy ideas. What's the solution? The solution has to be that when you take that modesty, that internal depth in the inside, and you bring it outside, you have to see in it that there's more hidden inside that you can't see. Then you've been true to what it is. I'm not sure that we're together. Let's say in a relationship, a man discovers a man who loves a woman. Now, this couple is married, and he discovers, right, this inner depth, this modesty, this hiddenness about her, should be in such a way that the more that he discovers, the more he sees there is to discover. That's an experience of depth. If you have the promise of discovering depth, and when you discover it, you see that it's not deep, it ends here, wherever it ends. But now it ends here. But that's not depth. The idea of the excitement and the inspiration of depth is that it keeps going. In order to show your inner depth, you have to have such an inner depth that it produces more. So that when I discover what there is of you to discover, I now realize that there's more that I didn't even realize that existed before that I had. And when I discover that, a whole new dimension unfolds. Can you imagine what marriage would be if we knew how to put this into it? That's what it should be. That's the mystery of a Jewish woman. In its deepest sense. That's what Torah is. The real understanding of Torah is that the more you see in it, the more you realize it's hidden beyond what you can see. Because if it weren't that way, if it were what you could see is then what you discovered, so then you would have just discovered that what looked infinite actually is finite. It's the very opposite of what it is. You've now taken something of unbelievable depth and you've actually shown that it's the opposite of that. That's not called bringing the inside out, that's called destroying it. And the secret is in how you appreciate it. If you're the kind of person who can bring this faculty into the world, or if you're not. The Gemara says that a person who doesn't know what Torah is, that's called Am Haaretz. And Am Haaretz is a person who doesn't understand anything about Torah. The Gemara says, Lema Deme, Lema Talmid Chacham Deme, Bifnei Am Haaretz, listen carefully, to what is a sage compared in the eyes of an Am Haaretz? You hear that? If a Torah sage, a man who understands Torah depth, has built himself into an object, into a sefer Torah. He's built himself into real Torah. How does an Am Haaretz, somebody who doesn't know anything about Torah, how does he see this individual? The Gemara says, like a vessel of gold. Kikiton shel zohav, like a golden vessel. That's how he sees him. Kevin shediber imoy, after he speaks to him once, he sees him like a silver vessel. And after he speaks to him more than once, and especially if he sits down and has a meal with him, he sees him like a broken piece of pottery. Hear this? Like a earthenware vessel that's not broken. Again, let's understand this. A person, what's being said here? It's a wonderful, wonderful mystical secret. What's being said? You have a man who doesn't understand anything about depth, a man who lives only in the superficial external world. He meets a sage of Torah depth. What does he see? A vessel of gold. A kiton always means something that holds liquid. It's a vessel, not just made of gold, but it contains depth, and it's made of gold. After he speaks to him once, now he gets a bit more familiar with him. He sees that he's human, he also speaks. As I speak, he speaks. Then already sees him like a vessel of silver. And after he brings himself down to his level, after they have some real contact, he speaks to him again, or they sit down and have a meal together, he says he actually eats. Then he sees him like a pottery vessel, the cheapest of all, and that it's broken already. That it's unable to hold anything. It couldn't hold much in the first place, had no intrinsic value, and now it's broken. The mystical depth of this is as follows. When you see someone whose depth you can't plumb, you know that he has tremendous depth. He's a Talmid Chacham, you know that he has Torah depth. We're talking about Torah. Then it's like a vessel of gold. Once you get familiar, and you've heard what he has to say, and you're not a person who understands that there's always more depth beyond what you can perceive, so then already his value drops tremendously. And after you become familiar to the point that your obtuseness, your opacity, your lack of being able to see depth has grasp this person's existence on the same level as yours, then you see him as nothing at all. The mistake that this person makes is everything that's exposed to him, he thinks that's all there is. So finally, when enough gets exposed, he thinks that everything has been exposed, there's nothing else. If a person understands what Torah depth is, he sees a person first as a golden vessel. The more that he sees of him, the more valuable, a person becomes. The more he sees in him, as I, for every bit that's exposed, it shows him that there's much more that he never knew about before, that he never knew existed before, never mind knew what its depth was. That is the Torah personality. A person who has the depth of Torah, that is a person who has covered, he has inner, that kind of dignity or significance or depth of personality. Just like a woman's modesty. Understand here what, it's too much to talk about tonight, what happened with the woman, Cosby and Zimri, the woman, but there's an inner depth here that the more you discover, the more that you see this woman has hidden. The more that you discover of this personality of this individual, the more you see it just shows you just an indication of the added depth that you didn't know about before. That's the nature of Torah. Torah is that object, that idea, that concept in the world, which is what represents Hashem's essence, Hashem's glory, Hashem's presence in the world. But Torah is such a nature that the more that you discover of it, the more you realize lies behind the scenes that you wouldn't have realized even was there if you hadn't seen this amount. That's why they say that it says, Va'aretz ha'ira mikvodo, that the land is lit up by Hashem's kavod, by Hashem's honor. The kavod of Hashem, the land is lit by that. The normal understanding is that when you see honor of a thing, then the lights go out. It means when you discover the inner depth of it, and you think that you've seen all there is, then it doesn't glow anymore. Just what we've been saying until now. But Hashem's honor is such that it lights the world. On the contrary, that the more it flows out, the more you can see it, the more it shows you that there's more behind it. Not like all superficial things, all physical things in the world. Physical things in the world that have a mysterious glow about them, once you've experienced them once, you're lucky if you don't feel disgust afterwards. Never mind, just don't feel that there's any more allure in it. But you often feel disgusted by the thing. But the honor of Hashem, of Hashem, which is Torah in the world, is such an object, such a concept, that the more you discover of it, the more light that it shines out, the more honor you see in it, which means the more you realize it's hidden. That's the idea of Kavod, which is the 32 pathways of wisdom, the hidden elements that make up any reality. That is something of what it is. One idea in Torah. Now, let's understand what was the base medrash of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, who was he first of all? What was going on there? The yeshiva of Rabbi Akiva, the base medrash of Rabbi Akiva, was very unusual. The Gemara says that the author, understand this, the author of the written law was Moshe Rabbeinu. The one who gave us the written law was Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu. The books of Moses, the five books of Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, the Chumash. He was the mouthpiece, the channel by which we received the written law. Who's the channel through which we receive the oral law? Says the Gemara Rabbi Akiva. Says the Gemara in Sanhedrin, V'kulu alibad Rabbi Akiva. Every facet, Sifri and Sifro and Midrash and Brises and Mishnas, the whole body of the oral law, all comes through Rabbi Akiva. Very, very remarkable. Understand who he was, this individual. But he was the individual through whom the oral law flows out into the world. What do we know about him? Very, very interesting. First of all, we have an idea. It says that he was able to teach things so deep in the oral law that, as it were, Moshe Rabbeinu himself didn't know. You know that? It says that Moshe Rabbeinu once asked Hashem to show him, you know this midrash? Moshe Rabbeinu asked Hashem to show him the future generations. Hashem took him through time and he showed him a generation of Rabbi Akiva. You understand why? And Moshe Rabbeinu walked into a base medrash and he sat in the back row. And the man teaching in the front was a man who lived much later. He traveled through time, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was teaching the oral law. And on every kait, it says, on every tug, every little dash on top of the letters, you know, the Sefer Torah, there are little crowns on some of the letters. From every little crown, it says he was teaching tilei tilim shel halachos, heaps, mountains of halachos, bringing out depth and depth and depth of Torah from every little crown on top of the letters. Of course, the crowns are the oral law. They're the part that aren't written. They just crown what is written. And you have to bring out orally what it is. When he started teaching these laws that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know. Moshe Rabbeinu himself didn't know the origin of these things. He heard this man. He brought Torah. He couldn't understand it. He brought Torah to the world. He was the author of it. And hearing the Torah that he gave to the world that only came because of him, here was a man teaching things that he hadn't seen in it. That he didn't perceive in it. understand what this means for another time, but so he started to get weak. He said to Hashem, if you have such a man in your world, why don't you give Torah through him? Why are you giving the Torah through me when you have a man like this who can do what seems to be things that I can't do? And he started to get weak. His mind started to get weak from this. Finally, the students in that base measure started asking Rabbi Akiva, what's the origin of this? What's the origin of this? What's the origin? Rabbi Akiva was deriving. Finally, they came to a point when they got to the rock bottom of the halacha. They asked Rabbi Akiva, what's the final derivation of this law? And Rabbi Akiva said, it's a halacha l'Moshe Nisinai. It comes from Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai. And then he suddenly realized, then it says that he was okay. He realized that even what Rabbi Akiva was bringing out actually comes from what he actually put into the world. The point is that we see from this that Rabbi Akiva was the giant of the oral law. When Moshe Rabbeinu was to be shown a man who was able to bring out the connection between the letters and what's above them, that immense and amazing world of the oral law, the man who was able to do that was Rabbi Akiva. And that's who Moshe Rabbeinu saw. Things that even he wasn't aware of in a certain sense, he saw that Rabbi Akiva could bring out. This ability to be able to bring out this hidden, different kind of a world. It says that Yitzhak loved Esav. You know that? Yitzhak had two sons, Yaakov, who learned Torah, and he had Esav. Yaakov, who sat in the tents and learned Torah, Jacob, and Esau, Esav. And it says that he loved Esav, ki tzayid b'fiv, because he had hunting in his mouth. Tzayid means the ability to trap, the ability to, he was a hunter. But the problem with the verse is, it says he was a hunter in his mouth. Tzayid b'fiv, he was a hunter in his mouth. What does it mean? It means he trapped things for him to eat. But I mean, what do literally the words mean? He saw that Esav was a hunter with his mouth. You know what a hunter with a mouth is? The ability to be involved in the oral law. What is the oral law? It's a way of hunting and tracking down and trapping and capturing things that are on the run. The written law doesn't have that. The written law has them where they are. They can't escape. But the oral law is what's swimming in between the lines and between the letters and in the crowns of the letters of the oral of the written law. That's what the oral law is. Being able to hold on to the oral Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, that's the ultimate form of hunting. And it says he loved him because he could smell in Esau, he felt, he perceived the root of the oral law. Where did it come out? Esau had a descendant. It was Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was the son of converts. He was from a non-Jewish family. In other words, there was an external line that led down to Rabbi Akiva, and they converted into Judaism, I think his father, and Rabbi Akiva, was from that line. So he came from that world, which was the origin of the world of Torah Shebaal Peh, all the way back in the days of Yitzhak. Yaakov and Esav, that's where its origin was. Now, what was the work, what was the job of the 24,000 Talmidim, students of Rabbi Akiva? To bring out oral law, to bring the oral law out into the world. That's what they were. That Beis Medrash with all those thousands of students, what they were absorbing the teaching of Rabbi Akiva. They were learning and teaching how to bring out that hidden depth, the depth of Torah, not what's explicitly written, what's between the lines, the depth that we call the oral law, Torah Shebaal Peh. Can you feel now what it means to give someone honor? It means to bring out the Torah that's within him. That's what it means. When these students were learning from each other. Do you know that it's very interesting? The Gemara doesn't say there were 24,000. It says there were 12,000 pairs. From that we learn that you should learn in Chavrusa. You should learn with somebody else. But it shows you that Torah learning is an interaction. Isn't that amazing? It shows you that Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students, but the way it puts it is that there were 12,000 pairs. Which means that what was being taught was the relationship that is Torah. Because it's in a relationship with somebody else in learning. Not like the written law where you read the words. Torah Shebaal Peh is in the interaction between me and you, in the war between me and you, which the Gemara says is a war, and in the end we love each other. In the war that takes place between me and you, I bring out your Torah and you bring out my Torah. The depth of my Torah is called my kavod. Giving honor to each other, the Gemara does not mean that they bowed and scraped, they should have stood up in their presence and so forth and showed them external honor. Of course they should have done that, and probably they did do that. The point is they didn't bring out kavod. Because each of those students was supposed to be focusing on the other one his partner, his chavrusa, and he was supposed to be bringing out his kavod, his neshama, into the world. He was supposed to be bringing out the Torah Shebaal Peh in the world. He was supposed to be bringing out that inner depth of Torah that even Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have explicitly. That was who Rabbi Akiva was. That was what was being taught in that Beis Midrash. That was what had to be brought out into the world. And that's what they didn't do. They forfeited their lives. Not because Hashem was being overly strict. That's what they were here for. They were sent down to the world again to do exactly that. And that's what they weren't doing. It's not a pettiness that they didn't show honor. They didn't stand up in each other. That's not the point. The point is they were brought to the world. They were given a second chance in the world, those 24,000 men who had died in the days of the tribe of Shimon. And they didn't do that. Let's trace our steps back some centuries to the tribe of Shimon and see what happened. What happened? Here was Zimri, took Cosby, this woman, for an immoral relationship. Who was standing around? The men of Shimon. You know what it says in Kabbalistic writings? That what was happening was an immoral relationship between a man and a woman. And who was standing around was, and allowing it, and not stopping it, and not able to teach that this is forbidden, bring out the halacha, that this is forbidden, and stop them, were the people of Shimon. Do you know what it says about Shimon? It says that the power of Torah learning in the Jewish people is vested in the tribe of Shimon. You know that? Of the oral law. The learning of the written law is vested in the tribe of Reuven. Reuven, why? Listen well. What does the word Reuven mean? To see. Ra'ah means to see. What does Shimon mean? To hear. Now, the written law you see. The oral law you have to hear. Let's understand this well. The written law you see, it's written down, isn't it? You open your eyes, you look on the lines, and you see it. But the oral law you have to do in the interaction between me and you, where I hear what you say. Much deeper than that. It's not just because the one you read and the one you hear. The depth of it is like this. The written law is what's stated explicitly. The Kabbalists say that what you can see is explicit and finite and a proof. There's nothing to talk about. It's there. You, for example, let's understand. When you see a thing, I'll give you two ways of understanding it. When you see a thing, the thing is that way. It couldn't be any other way. Seeing is believing. That's what they say. Seeing is believing. Why? Because the word re'iyah in Hebrew, which means to see, is also re'ayah, which means a proof. When you see a thing, it's a proof. You can't move out of that. There's no room to maneuver, to move, to bring out other levels. What you see is what you get. Seeing is believing. If you rearrange the letters of re'iyah, it spells ariyeh, a lion. And a lion in Hebrew, the gematria of that word is gevura, power. What you see forces itself on you like a lion. It takes a hold of you, you can't move out of it. If I show you something, even if you don't agree with me, but I show it to you, can't disagree anymore. It's a proof, you have to agree. You follow? That is what seeing means. Hearing is completely different. Hearing, the mystics say, happens in the darkness. When you hear, for example, when you see a thing, all the elements that you see at once. Is that right? When you look at a scene, all the elements of that scene you perceive all at once. It's a unique and complete experience in itself. You do not have to interact with the scene in order to see it. Are you with me? You don't have to construct it or put it together. It's there, you see it. When you hear, the experience of hearing does not happen outside of you like seeing. I'm talking mystically. The experience of hearing happens inside of you. Let me explain that. When I talk to you, how do you hear what I'm saying? You certainly don't hear it all at once. You hear one sound, then the next, then the next, then the next, and you put it together. It happens inside your head. When you hear someone speaking, the first syllable goes in, and that's faded away by the time the next sound comes in. And by the time the third sound comes, the second has faded away. How do you understand what the person said? At the end of the whole experience, you put it together. Hearing is an experience, mystically, it's the experience of the oral law. That's why it's oral, it's spoken, and the place it lives is where you hear it. Again, are we together? Hearing is an experience of taking a transmission, taking a process, none of which remains in the world, and the only place the whole of it lives, the entirety of it, the totality, the oneness of it lives, is in your own mind. You construct it, you put it together. It's a completely subjective experience. Are you with me? Do you know that the word Shema in Hebrew, which means to hear, Hear O Israel, Shema Israel, Hashem Elokeinu, the word Shema actually means to build oneness out of fragments. Do you know that? It says in Tanakh, Vayishama Shol Esa'am, Shol gathered the nation together. What's the expression the Tanakh uses for gathering people together? Shema, he heard. It doesn't mean he heard, it means he gathered them into one. Can you hear that? Isn't that beautiful? The expression of hearing means gathering sounds and put them into oneness. You may realize that's how we say Shema Israel. Shema Israel, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. When we want to make Hashem's oneness apparent in the world, how do we do it? We say, listen, We don't say see. We could have said see, O Israel. Feel. No. We don't use those words. We say Shema. Shema means to take broken down bits and pieces and make echad out of them. That's what Shema Israel means. It means that I'm using my inner faculty of putting broken pieces together, which is what the world looks like, to hear the oneness that comes out of it. I hear that. I can't show it to you. I can't show it to you because you can't see it. You can hear it, but that you have to do. I can't do that for you. That's why it's a mystical death, a mystical wisdom. It happens only inwardly. It's a remarkable example. Whenever you read something in Torah that's explicit, we always talk about seeing it. For example, when you read the Sefer Torah, you read it and you see it. If you want something explicit, like in the higher forms of the deeper wisdom, this is an amazing paradox, but just at one level. If you read the Zohar, the greatest mystical depth, that presents things so clearly, presents the mystical world in such a way that you can't move from it. In fact, the Kabbalists say, "Emes eid la'atzmoy," the truth is a witness to itself. When you show the deeper truth in a beautiful way, that's perfectly put, you can't move from it. It absolutely shows itself to be true. So when the Zohar in the Talmud Yerushalmi, also a higher special thing, when it wants to show you something, it says, "Tachazi," come and see. In the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, which is a world of broken down bits and pieces that we're always laboring to put together, when it wants to teach you something, it says, "Tashma," come and hear. Isn't that beautiful? When you deal with that part of Torah, where you have to put yourself in and put the broken down pieces into one and construct your own mind, it introduces statements by saying, "Tashma, come and hear." But in the Kabbalistic depth, which brings out depth into explicit, so you see it crystal clear, it says, "Tachazi," come and see. Of course, in the final oneness of the world, when the fire, the Lag BaOmer fire, the fire of Torah, when it comes out into the world completely explicitly, then of course you'll be able to see sounds. Won't you? Isn't that obvious? When the world of hidden death is made explicit, there won't be anything to hear. It will all be seen. Can you feel that? And that's why it says that at Sinai, when the hidden world of Hashem's presence was revealed explicitly, what does it say? That the nation saw the sounds. It says that the Jewish nation saw the sounds. The sounds of Sinai, the thunder that was surrounding the mountain, it says they saw it, didn't they? They heard it. It says that in Chumash. How do they see the sounds? Of course they saw the sounds. When Hashem appears, there's nothing to hear. Hearing means you put together the bits and pieces and you reconstruct it when you see it all, when you put it all together. When Hashem appears, there's nothing to hear, you see it all. And that's why it says when the Mashiach arrives, it says, "V'ra'u kol baso yachdav," that all flesh together will see. "V'ra'u kol baso yachdav," all flesh will see. "Ki pi Hashem diber," that Hashem's mouth has spoken. You don't see somebody's mouth spoken. You hear somebody's mouth spoken, but it doesn't say that. When the Mashiach comes, you won't be hearing what Hashem is saying. You'll be seeing it. Anybody out there with me? You hear it. Shimon is the tribe that's called Shama. Shimon, ki Shama Hashem. Hashem has heard, she said, when he was born, his mother. She named him for hearing, Shimon. Reuven is because Hashem has seen. Reuven is the one whose eyes function. Reu, to see. So Reuven is the nation, is the tribe of the Jewish nation, the Shevet, the part of the Jewish people who are able to see clearly. They are the source of our ability to learn Torah Shemiksav, the written Torah. But Shimon is the tribe that can hear clearly. And they are the Shevet, they are the part of Klal Yisrael that's the source of our ability to hear the oral law. That's Shimon. Now what happened? There was a sin going on, and the men of Shimon were standing around. What's the job of the people of Shimon? To hear between the lines the halacha, to be able to know with certainty the inner depth of Torah, to know with clarity what has to be done in the situation. Here's a Jewish man, never mind the sin itself and how it relates here, but here's a Jewish man who's taken a non-Jewish woman. He's about to perform a sin with her. He is performing a sin with her. The tribe of Shimon are the ones who should be able to bring out the halacha. They go to Moshe Rabbeinu. Isn't it amazing? They go to Moshe Rabbeinu and they say, "What's the law?" They come and they say to him, "Yes?" Zimri himself says to Moshe Rabbeinu, "What is the law?" Instead of knowing what it is, instead of being the one who has to bring it out into the world, right? He's the one who is asking. He lacks it. He doesn't have the Torah Shebal Peh. And Shimon doesn't have it. The one who's supposed to be bringing it out. The men of the tribe of the Jewish people who are able to bring out the oral law in the world, you show a lack of it. A plague that wipes out 24,000. By the way, you notice the beauty. Moshe Rabbeinu, the source of the written law, when they ask him something in the oral law, he doesn't say. It has to come from that part of Klal Yisrael which can bring out the oral law. Isn't that what happens to Rabbi Akiva? When Moshe Rabbeinu is transported through the generations and he stands in the base midrash of Rabbi Akiva and the students ask a question and Moshe Rabbeinu himself doesn't know. And he hears Rabbi Akiva bringing it out. Isn't that what it is? The same man, Rabbi Akiva, is the man, the force in the Jewish people that bring out the oral law. That force can bring out things that, as it were, Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't even have. The mystics say it's not that he doesn't know it, but he has it so explicitly that by him it's not oral. He doesn't have to search between the lines for it. But be that as it may, the point is he doesn't say it. So you have exact parallel situation. Can you feel it? In the days of Cosby and Zimri, in the days of Shimon, the men of Shimon, they're standing around. The people should be able to hear a halacha so sensitively that at any second they should know what it is. They should feel it in their bones. They should be able to bring it out. They should hear it even when it's not clear. They show that they don't know it. And they say to Moshe, when they ask him a question, what is the law? You don't know it. You have it wrong. You're the ones who bring this to the world. That's your life. That's your covenant. That's your heart. That's what you are in the world. A plague breaks out and 24,000 of them die. How does it stop? Pinchas jumps forward and he says, I'll bring out the halacha. I know what the halacha is. A man like this must die. And he teaches it and he does it and the plague stops. Let's move through history again to Rabbi Akiva. You have the base medrash of Rabbi Akiva. What's his job in the world? To bring out Torah Shabbat there. Who's bringing it out? He's 24,000 students. Given a chance to do it again. Reincarnated neshamas. The same men who died in the plague once before in the days of when they were represented as the tribe of Shimon, because they didn't get it right. Their job in the world was to bring out their kavod, ura kavodi, to awaken the neshama, to bring out the 32 dimensions of the lamed beis, of the lev, that is their Torah in the world, the oral law. They didn't get it right. Hashem gives them a chance again. He takes all 24,000 of them, exactly the same neshamas, and he brings them down into Rabbi Akiva's base measures and get it right this time. What happens? They didn't bring out the kavod, the chav beis vav dalet. They didn't bring out the 32 elements of lamed beis, of lev. They don't bring it out of each other. That's what they put you here to do, and they don't extract, they don't live in such a way that each of those 24,000, each of those 12,000 pairs, that each one's extracting the oral law from his partner, that it's glowing in the world, that he's making a tikkun, he's making a correction for what went wrong back there in the midbar, in the desert, when they didn't bring it out. Of course what happens? The same thing again. The 24,000 of them, they die with a plague. Exactly the same. Exactly the same thing. That is what the Arizal means when he says that they were a Gilgal, they were reincarnation of the same plague, the same people, same event, same mistake. And it's because of that, now you understand why we have mourning for the days of the Omer. For 32 days of the Omer, the 32 days of working, of building ourselves from Pesach to Shavuos, the work of building, we build the inner dimensions of the neshama, we build it from Pesach to Shavuos, we build in Torah. What do you mean build your neshama? Muscle. Not about muscle, we're talking about Torah. That's your kavod, that's your 32, that's who you are, that's your lade, your heart is the hidden Torah within you, the Torah Shebaal Peh. That's your neshama, the Torah that's you, that's hidden within you, the kind of Torah that's in you that the more we see of it, the more we realize it is to be seen. That's what's built at this time of year. When that time of year comes along, and it's in that time of year that Hashem gives them a chance to do it again, and they fail in that time of year, so it costs their lives. Their lives were only given for that. They were reincarnation. Their lives had been given once and they got it wrong. Their life was only given now to get that right, and they got that wrong. They were put into the world at the time when life is that. And that they don't do. So they forfeit their lives immediately. You know, that, let's finish in the next few minutes, let's just say that the 32 dimensions of Kavod, of Lev, that are the Torah Shebaal Peh, that is this process of development from Pesach to Shavuos. You know that some places they ask the following question. Understand the most beautiful, beautiful idea. We're allowed to talk a bit deeper, no? On Lag BaOmer. Once here we can talk a little bit of these subtle and deeper ideas. You know, some commentaries ask like this. You know that Sfiras HaOmer, listen to this, amazing, amazing idea. It's called counting the Omer. You know what the Omer is? The Omer is the sacrifice, the korban that's brought at Pesach time. Not Shavuos time, Pesach time. Which means we're counting the Pesach. We're not counting the Shavuos, we're counting the Omer, we're counting the Pesach. You know, there are commentaries, the Maharal asks this question. Surely when you count towards something, you count off the days. You tick off how many days left, don't you? When anybody's waiting for something to happen, do you count how many days have gone by? You count how many days are left, don't you? Don't you tick it off and get smaller and smaller until there are only 10 days left, only 9, only 8? Isn't that how you count it? That's what people do. Yeah, definitely. So aren't we aiming towards Shavuos? Isn't the counting, listen carefully, isn't the counting from Pesach towards Shavuos? Aren't we trying to get to that transcendent level of Torah? We're talking about Torah. We're talking about 49 levels that get you to Torah. 48 kinyonim of Torah. The 49th is the revision of all of them. 49 days towards Shavuos. Not about 49 stam. We're talking 49 days from Pesach, which is you barely begin to be human. You save for free. And then you work through 49 days of work. But what's the work for to get you to Torah? Surely we should be counting backwards. Shouldn't we be saying 49 days left? 48 days left? 47? Surely? Aren't we moving towards Shavuos? And how come we count 1 day since Pesach? 2 days since Pesach? Sfiras HaOmer, what we did on Pesach. Wrong, isn't it? Now, beautiful question. The answer is this. Don't understand. The way you get to Shavuos is by building those elements in yourself. If you tick off the days, what it means is that there's a passive process, right? How many days left till I get there? Less, 1 day less, 1 day less. But that doesn't show me that I'm building. What happens is when you count one, that's one element that I built in my neshama. Oh, I'm closer to Shavuos. The second day, I built the second element in my neshama. You follow what's happening? I built the third element. What you're enjoying is the building on the Omer. You take the animal dimension of Pesach. You count one level that you've worked on it that you didn't have before. That's the glow of the Omer. We're counting Torah, we're counting towards Shavuos, but the only way you get to Shavuos is we add on to Pesach. Isn't it beautiful? You're adding on. You build another level, and another level, and another. When you build all 49 levels, man, you'll be there. You don't tick off what's left to go as if the experience is happening. You're building what you... Not what's left. You're building what you're building. You won't get there. If you ticked off the days, you wouldn't be any closer. You don't tick off days. What you're doing is you're building elements that you didn't have before, and that's how you get there. When you build 32 of them, when you've worked on 32 of them, you've built up from Pesach, and you've built 32 levels. You've built Chavoit, you've built the Neshama. The Neshama is 32. Chav Beis, Vav Dalet. The 32 elements of the Neshama that spell life. The 22 letters of Aleph Beis, and the 10 mystical dimensions that make them all move, that make them alive. You've done it all already. Now all you have is Toiv. Now there's 17 days to bring out the goodness of it, that it should be born in the world. Healthy, fit and healthy, a live child. That's fit and healthy. But the body's been built already. Can you feel that? That's the 32 elements that are the elements of the neshama, the conception of the child, the pregnancy. All those things have been done now. You can't go wrong now. Now it's a question of feeding, nurturing. But it's all been built now. The genes are all in place. All the elements, if they've been properly built, they've been built now. That's why it's the fifth of the fifth week. The fifth week is, the first week is the right side. The second is the left side. The third is the joint between the two in the middle. The fourth is the right kidney, where let's say the seed of a child starts to be formed. The fifth is where the seed is completed. You know that? The sixth is marriage between man and woman, and the seventh is what's produced. But in making the seed that will be a child, the father first of all takes his beginning. Then he takes his concept of how he limits that beginning. Then he has to balance those two. Now the father is here. Then the father starts to take those three things that are him, and he starts to make a seed that will be his child. Then he finishes the seed. Can you feel that? That's the fifth dimension. After the seed is finished, it's a question of nurturing, that it should be given over correctly and loyally, that the woman should build it, that the child should actually come out into the world. But the seed has been built when you've got to the fifth of seven levels. Are you with me? And that's why the fifth day of the fifth week is a day of happiness. In fact, the Kabbalists say that that's why Rav Shimon bar Yochai died on this day. Because all that needed to be taught had been taught. The inner dimension of Torah, the Kabbalistic depth of Torah, the 32 elements that are the essential elements, the Chavoy, the Lev, the Neshama of Torah, the Kabbalistic inner depth of Torah, had been built by this day. And he could die, and it could be a day of happiness. Because once you build that perfectly, it's safe in the world. While the seed is being formed, it's a very anxious time. Maybe the seed won't be formed. Once the seed is being formed, it just needs to fall into the earth and disintegrate in the earth, and it will grow a new tree. That's why it was the day of the 33rd day, that it was a day of happiness, the teaching was done already, that inner depth of Torah Sheba'al Peh, that hidden wisdom was brought out on that day, the sun didn't go down, the light of Torah, Aretz Ha'ira Mikvoidoi, the light of Torah shone on that day, even as he left the world on that day. So the light of Torah was shone, that brings out the light in the hidden darkness, what seems to be the darkness of the hidden world of Torah. That's what's brought out on that day. The happiness what you want. The happiness of Lag BaOmer is that of the 49 days of building Torah, they all turned to mourning. They turned to days of mourning. They were supposed to be the Yontif of Torah. You know that? Pesach to Shavuos was supposed to be one long Yontif. Pesach is where it begins. The 49 stages in building, you build one on top of the other, on top of the next one. When you reach the 49th dimension, they're all complete. Automatically, you rocket into the 50th transcendent dimension. Pesach and Shavuos were all meant to be one long Yontif, wasn't it? Pesach is slavery, from slavery to freedom, the freedom to build, to what? To build to Torah. It's all the Yontif of Torah. Pesach is the beginning, and Shavuos is the completion. And what happened? We were given a Pesach, but the work of building in between, the Pesach dimension still remains a Yontif, because that's what Hashem does. He takes us out of Mitzrayim, takes us out of freedom. But the 49 days that He leaves us in the desert to work, those turn to mourning. Because the work of bringing out Torah Sheba'al Peh, the work of bringing out the hidden depth of Torah, that's not apparent in the world. That's up to us. We didn't do it. The men of Shimon didn't do it when they should have. They forfeited their lives. They were given a chance again to do it in the days of Rabbi Akiva, the core of Torah Sheba'al Peh, Rabbi Akiva, who represents Torah Sheba'al Peh in the world. He has to bring it out into the world. They don't do it again. So these 49 days turn to mourning. There's only one Yontif that's left. Only one element of that whole pathway remains as a day of happiness. A little bit that's left over. It should have been the entire 49, all the 7 times 7 mystical dimensions that it should have lit the world, right? We only have one in 49 that's left. After 32 elements have been failed, those 32 elements that should have been built, they haven't been built, but that one little flicker, a little bit of Torah Sheba'al Peh, if you like this, the light of Rishon Bar Yochai, the hidden mystical depth that those who merit to can study, that little flicker of a fire, you light a bonfire for that. That flicker, that just one tiny dimension of all those that should have been, that one little one that remains alive. So that is the only day that remains a Yontif, but it's a day of Yontif, of happiness within a sphere that's sad. It's a time that should have been a time of growth towards Torah and should take us to Shavuos, but it's that one last little speck that is all that remains. What we have to know is that you have to take this day, you have to take the fire of Lag BaOmer, that one little spark, and almost, if that goes out, there's nothing left. If all 49 are not here, then there's nothing at all to link Pesach and Shavuos. If there's none of the 49, there's no Torah at all. That one last little spark is the spark that can relight the fire. If that depth of sensitivity, of bringing out Kavod, of bringing out the hidden Torah that's in, not that's written on parchment, the hidden Torah that's Rabbi Akiva's Torah, that's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's Torah, the hidden Torah of the inner world, if that little spark doesn't die, that remains alive, if a person can at least keep that tiny, tiny flicker of life going, of Kavod going in his neshama, so then what will happen, instead of being a time where there's nothing alive, a person will still have a life, that lamed base, 32 elements that spell lave that are inside, and a person will have his kavod, his dignity, his kavod, his 32 elements of neshama that are Torah, they'll still be there. And Yemitz Hashem, all that will have to be done then is fanning that spark into a flame so that all 49 again can form the one transition from the freedom of Pesach to the emes of Torah of Shavuos.